me start by just briefly reviewing some results for the last from the last like 1.5 lectures, and then I'll pause for questions. So I've been talking about single field slow roll inflation, which has a background solution plus perturbations. So the background is specified by two functions. Phi of t and a. They evolve with the exact equations of motion. As follows. And in the slow roll approximation, which means that the quantities epsilon and eta are small, defined as follows. Then it's a good approximation to integrate these simplified equations of motion instead. So that's the that's the background. And then yesterday I sketched the physics of the fluctuations, leaving, for many of the calculations, I just explained how to set up the calculation and then quoted the result without actually doing the calculation, since the calculations can be really long. At least in the gauge that I'm using, there's in the so-called unitary gauge, the phi fluctuations have been gauged away. And there's the dynamical quantities are a scalar field of zeta that depends in the trace of the on the diagonal of the spatial metric, and some gravity wave degrees of freedom, gamma ij. Gamma ij degrees of freedom satisfy the following constraints. It may help to say that for sort of counting the degrees of freedom in gamma ij, it may help to say that if, actually let me write this derivative as a k. Since I wrote it down in Fourier space over here. So it may help to write out these constraints explicitly in a coordinate system where the wave number k points in the z direction. Then these constraints imply that for each wave number, at wave number k, the most general gamma ij that you can get looks like this. Remember that gamma ij is symmetric. Because it's the space-space part of the metric, let me also write that down. For a symmetric tensor, the vanishing of this quantity means that you just have zeros on the in the matrix entries involving z. And then the symmetry and traceless conditions force these two elements to be negatives of each other and these two to be equal. Anyway, this is just to explain that in an explicit coordinate system, that there are two degrees of freedom in this object, gamma ij. And then the physics or dynamics of the perturbations is It's all contained in the Mukunov Sasaki action. One little comment here is that so this action is quadratic in the fields, and it's actually an expansion of the full nonlinear GR action to second order. If you compute it to higher order, you would get some non-zero cubic terms. Those cubic terms do turn out to be small, as I guess is implied by the fact that we're not considering them. But showing that is really a long calculation. Okay. So the Mukunov-Sasaki action is the action of the fluctuations to second order. It's almost the same thing as the equations of motion to first order, which we also wrote down yesterday. The equations, you can derive the equations of motion to first order if you vary the Mukunov-Sasaki action. And conversely, the first order equations of motion determine the second order action up to an overall constant. So the overall constant prefactors here are really why we needed this action. Just as a little comment, in classical mechanics, the overall normalization of the action doesn't matter. It drops out when you get the classical equations of motion. But in quantum mechanics, the normalization matters. One nice way of seeing that conceptually is to consider a path integral of the form e to the I action over h bar. Rescaling the action is equivalent to rescaling h bar and changes the size of quantum effects. What I'm going to do today is start, the next step is to quantize this action and see what happens when we put in quantum mechanics in this inflationary spacetime. One comment there is that because this action is quadratic, even though we're doing quantum field theory, it's free quantum field theory in the sense that there are no interactions. Each K-mode evolves independently. You might think that free QFTs are never very interesting, that they're always kind of trivial. And I suppose that's true if you don't have time dependence. You know, then you have a sort of a boring situation where particles just sort of go through each other. But some interesting things can happen when there's large time dependence in the action. Even though, yeah, it all goes into propagators, not vertices of Feynman rules, it can still be physically interesting. I actually think that today I may not end up using any of the equations that are on the board. I'm going to build up the quantization of this action, sort of step by step, just starting with a 1D harmonic oscillator. And I don't know if I'll quite get to the full inflationary action by the end of the lecture. But I wanted to review what I did last time and sort of explain why I'm doing the quantum mechanics today. Before I change focus and start talking about quantization, are there any questions on the stuff on the Slack board or any of the things that we talked about previously? Okay. So, so if not, I'm going to start talking about quantization. Before I get to QFT examples, I'm going to warm up with a time-dependent harmonic oscillator. This is just a Schrodinger equation quantum mechanics. But all the essential physics is contained in this 0+1 dimensional example. So the setup is just going to be, I have the usual harmonic oscillator from quantum mechanics. The only difference is that the frequency omega is now some specified function of time. To make it a little more concrete, I want to assume that at early times, or to reduce generality in a way that will be helpful for eventually for the QFT example, I'm going to make the assumption that at early times, the frequency goes to some constant value omega naught. At those early times, then, the harmonic oscillator just reduces to, you know, the usual thing with some states labeled 0, 1, 2, and so on, which are energy eigenstates. I'll assume that the system starts at the ground state. Give a goal, something that we're trying to calculate. Let's say that at later times we're trying to compute the variance. The expectation value of the operator X squared. Just to kind of get sort of a hand-wavy sense of the physics. So one thing that's true is that at early times, we know that the wave function is the omega x squared over 2 or 4? I think 2. So this expectation value would just be something like 1 over 2 omega? Omega squared? I think I'm doing that correctly. What happens at later times depends on whether the time dependence here is slow, adiabatic, or sudden. If the time dependence is slow, meaning that the derivative of omega is small compared to 1 over omega squared, which is the only time scale, then what will happen is that as the Hamiltonian changes, there's a theorem that tells you that the system stays in its ground state. That happens generally for adiabatic changes in the Hamiltonian. On the other hand, in the limit where the change is sudden, then what will happen is the Hamiltonian changes quickly before the wave function has a chance to adapt. Then you end up in an excited state because the ground state for one value of omega will not be the ground state at a different value of omega. It'll be some linear combination of excited states. So in general, time dependence of the Hamiltonian can excite the system out of its ground state. That's the essential physics that will eventually show gives rise to particle production in this action when applied to every k mode of the field. Just to state in advance what the answer is, the answer has to this question of computing the variance. It has a really simple answer, and I want to try to explain conceptually where it comes from. So the answer is that the answer in general will turn out to be that this expectation value is the square of something called the mode function, where the mode function U of t is the solution to the classical equation of motion for the oscillator. A specific initial condition that it goes to 1 over 2 omega 1 half e to the minus I omega t at early times. Um, So if you just pretend that you're doing classical mechanics, evolving the classical equation of motion for the oscillator, with the differences that this is a complex solution, not a real solution, and it has this particular initial condition, then you just square to get the expectation value of x squared quantum mechanically. So to explain where this comes from, I want to work in the Heisenberg picture. And I thought it might be helpful to just sort of review that a bit. So one reason for reviewing it is that you may have seen the Heisenberg picture only in the case where the Hamiltonian is time independent. So I wanted to just write it down for a time dependent Hamiltonian. One way to do quantum mechanics is the Schrodinger picture, where the wave function evolves via Schrodinger's equation. I'm putting the subscript s on the Hamiltonian just to be clear about which operators are Schrodinger picture versus Heisenberg picture operators. And I'm allowing the Hamiltonian to be time dependent. In the Schrodinger picture, there's an evolution operator. Because Schrodinger equation is linear, then there's an evolution operator u of t comma t zero that will evolve from any wave function at time t zero to the wave function at time t. And this is the thing that, if the Hamiltonian is independent of time, is the e to the minus iht. Independent of time. In general, just follows from integrating Schrodinger's equation, a formula for it that I'm not really going to use. But a QFT style formula for it is to replace this quantity by the corresponding time ordered exponential. So in the Heisenberg picture, you don't evolve the state, you evolve operators instead. So for any operator O, the Heisenberg picture operator O sub H is defined by taking the corresponding Schrodinger picture operator. And putting in the time evolution from t0 to t, and then its conjugate, which evolves backwards from t to t0. Where I allowed the Schrodinger picture operator to have explicit time dependence because I want to apply this definition in particular to the Hamiltonian, which has time dependence. And then the equivalence between the two pictures is that if I want to calculate the expectation value of some operator at some time, then I can either do that by taking the Schrodinger wave function and sandwiching the operator, or leaving the wave function in its initial state and sandwiching the Heisenberg version of the operator. The definitions have been arranged so that the two are equivalent. And then Then I just have a couple more equations. So one general property of this definition is that Heisenbergizing an operator commutes with multiplication, or similarly with taking commutators. And so in particular, one thing that's always true in both the Heisenberg and Schrodinger pictures is that if I commute the operator x with the operator p, then I get I. And that's shown as follows. By this property, if these Heisenberg picture operators are evaluated at the same time, I can compute that commutator by taking the commutator of the Schrodinger picture operators and then Heisenbergizing. And the Schrodinger picture commutator is equal to I. And then Heisenbergizing a multiple of the identity just gives back the same thing. So this is called the canonical commutator. The commutator of x and p, or more generally, any quantity with its conjugate momentum, is always equal to I in quantum mechanics. And then finally, there's the Heisenberg equation of motion. If you want to solve a theory in the Heisenberg picture, or determine the time dependence of operators like x and p, then it's generally true that the time derivative of OH, so there's a term that comes from the time dependence of the Heisenbergization. Not sure if that's a real word in the sense that any references use it. Which I'll remind you that this commutator can be computed either in the Heisenberg picture, as I've written it here, or you could also compute the commutator in the Schrodinger picture and then Heisenbergize, or put in the sandwich in between the U's. Plus a term that arises if the Schrodinger picture operator itself has explicit time dependence. So this is straightforward to show given the definitions. I suppose if you want to show that, an equation that I should have written down is that the time derivative of the U operator is equal to minus IH times U. Just satisfies the same Schrodinger equation that the states satisfy. Okay. So now I'll solve the time-dependent harmonic oscillator in the Heisenberg picture. At the initial time, the Heisenberg and Schrodinger picture operators are the same. And I'm going to write the result. I want to write everything at the in the end in terms of initial time ladder operators. I'm going to put the subscript 0 in there to indicate that these are neither Schrodinger nor Heisenberg picture operators, but just the ladder operators at the defined at the initial time. Where the commutator is one. And the Heisenberg picture, and likewise for P. Now I need to work out the Heisenberg equations of motion. I'll put those over here. Putting H subscripts on everything just to be really unambiguous. So the Hamiltonian looks like this. Then this term is zero since XH always commutes with XH squared. And then to compute this term, so first, I'm going to notice that when I commute p squared with x, then I pick up two. I want to write the result in terms of the commutator of p with h. So I'll write the result this way. So if I want to commute two p's past an x, then there's this term when I commute past the first p, and then there's this second term where I commute past the second p. If you're skeptical, you can multiply it out and see how it's equal. And then this is just the canonical commutator. So if I can write this as p, since the commutator of p with x is minus I. And so this is the same as the classical equation of motion. This always happens. If you carefully work out the Heisenberg picture equations of motion for an operator, then you get back something which is algebraically the same as the classical equation of motion, just interpreted with operators everywhere. The only catch is that if you end up with expressions on the right-hand side, like say x, suppose we'd ended up here with like something like x times p, then the classical equation of motion becomes ambiguous in quantum mechanics because x and p no longer commute. And so then you'd have to go through a procedure like this to figure out the correct operator ordering. But for simple examples, you could just sort of write down what the Heisenberg equation of motion is and then go through this procedure if you want to check. Similarly, the derivative of the p operator is minus omega of t squared times the x operator. Okay. So now we've written down the initial conditions and the equations of motion to solve. So first, I just want to notice that since the equations of motion are linear, then x and p must be linear combinations of A0 and A0 dagger at all times. And this is the key observation that makes the Heisenberg picture simpler than the Schrodinger picture. If at some time t, the operators x and p are linear combinations of these other two operators, a0 and a0 dagger, then applying any linear equations of motion to x and p that just have x and p on the right-hand side will stay in that space of operators spanned by a0 and a0 dagger. So one thing that I can write down right away it in matrix form is that these operators will be some matrix times a0 and a0 dagger. Okay. And then I'll start deducing some constraints on the entries of this matrix. So I'll just define this entry to be some function u of t. And then I'll notice that this matrix entry has to be u star. Because x is always a Hermitian operator. And so that's only true if the coefficient of a0 is the complex conjugate of the coefficient of a0 dagger. And then the next thing I can notice is that since one of the equations of motion says that p is equal to x dot, that the coefficients of a0 and a0 dagger and p must be the derivatives of the corresponding coefficients for x. And then the last observation is that by the Heisenberg picture equation of motion for p, I can write, so the derivative of p should be minus omega squared times x. And that implies that just reading off the coefficients of a0 and a0 dagger, that uw dot should be minus omega t squared times u. So now I've solved the theory in the Heisenberg picture. So I have to integrate a differential equation, the same equation as the classical equation of motion for the oscillator, u double dot equals minus omega squared u, with an initial condition. I didn't quite finish. I didn't say what the initial conditions were. So those you can read off from here. So at early times, I know that u should approach. The first equation here tells me that u is 1 over 2 omega naught to the 1/2. And then the second equation tells me that u dot is minus I times omega naught over 2 to the 1/2. I could put both of these together by saying that u of t is 2 omega naught to the 1/2 times e to the minus I omega naught t. So at early times, when omega is constant, the differential equation has two solutions, a solution with time dependence e to the minus I omega naught t, and a piece with time dependence e to the I omega naught t. And it's this initial condition which is setting the negative frequency solution. So now I have a complete solution for the theory in the Heisenberg picture. There's this initial condition on the function u of t. that comes from the initial conditions. Then this differential equation that lets me evolve the function u of t into the future. And then this expression for the Heisenberg picture operators x and p in terms of the mode function at later times. And if I wanted some other Heisenberg picture operator built out of x and p, I could get it by multiplying multiplying x's and p's together. So then I said that my goal was to compute the expectation value of x squared. And so if I'm computing that in the Heisenberg picture, then I sandwich two Heisenberg x's between initial vacuum states. In the Heisenberg picture, I leave the initial state unchanged and put the Heisenberg time-dependent operator in between. And then to write that out, so xh is, there's this function u of t. So I have two of these. I'll write them out separately. And then I'll note that this term vanishes because if I apply an annihilation operator to the vacuum ket, I get zero. Similarly, this term vanishes. If I multiply the vacuum bra on the right by a creation operator, I get zero. And so keeping the only non-zero term, I get uu star times 0, 0, 0. And then that expectation value is 1, either from the explicit forms of these latter operators or because the commutator a 0 dagger is 1. And so this was the result that I wanted to show. And I chose the expectation value of x squared, but I could have chosen some other operator. It can be written down in terms of this mode function because the mode function is just sort of that one function of t is controlling like the entire solution of the theory in the Heisenberg picture. Another comment is that we didn't really use in solving the theory the constraint that this canonical commutator is supposed to equal I. Let me put the t's in there to emphasize that this is supposed to be evaluated at equal times. Just kind of as a check, let me check that that's true for my solution. I always try to do this sort of thing when I do calculations, find some check that didn't go in as an input to make sure I didn't make an algebra mistake. So writing out the my solution for xh and ph, write that out like this. U dot star. Zero dagger. And now you can see that I'm going to get two terms. I don't get a term from commuting A0 with A0, but I do get something non-zero if I compute, for example, the first term here with an A0 with the last term here with an A0 dagger. Here's a nice way of writing those two terms. I'll let you stare at this and see that the two terms that you get when you expand out this determinant are the same as the two terms that you get when you take this commutator. You may have seen this type of determinant in a differential equations class. It's called a Wronskian determinant. Just to give a little more context, for an nth order linear differential equation, it's an n by n determinant where each column of the matrix corresponds to one of the n independent solutions. And then you have time derivatives appearing in the rows, like the first row just has the solutions, the second row has first derivatives, third row has second derivatives, and so on. For our equation of motion, the two independent solutions are u and u star. We actually have a little bit of a puzzle in trying to establish that this canonical commutator, on physical grounds, we expect it to be I. It's not obvious that this Wronskian determinant is equal to I for all times. Let me give this a name and call it W. So to show that, or W of T. So let me sketch the proof of how you would show that. One thing that you can show directly from the equations of motion is that the derivative dW dt is equal to zero. So this follows from the equations of motion. It's generally true, like the significance of this Wronskian determinant in like a math context, a differential equations context, is that it always satisfies some like simple first order differential equation, giving rise to a conserved quantity. For this equation of motion, it just turns out to be W dot equals zero. Using the initial condition that the mode function has this negative frequency form at early times, you can show that W equals I. Let me actually write out the equation of motion just to make it concrete. W of T naught is equal to I. Follows since at early times. If you plug this this choice of mode function into the definition of W, then it's easy to see that you get I. Another little comment is that, like, one thing you might wonder is whether, because you seem to have a lot of, whether you could ever, like, set the mode function to zero through some choice of omega of t. There seems to be a lot of flexibility, like here. Like, you start out with this mode function, and then imagine having, like, a dial that you can turn to adjust the frequency of the oscillator omega of t. There seems to be like a lot of freedom to control the differential equation.
And maybe you could try to set U to zero and just remove all zero point energy from the oscillator. Of course, we know that shouldn't happen in quantum mechanics. You can never get rid of, there's no state of the harmonic oscillator with no zero point energy. And the way that you prove that that can't happen is that for any choice of omega of t, this commutator or this determinant has to be equal to I. And so you wouldn't be able to make u of zero, you wouldn't be able to set u to zero, even instantaneously at some time t, because then this determinant would have to vanish. Okay, so I think I've now beaten to death the time-dependent harmonic oscillator. I remember when I first saw this subject, it's somehow like, I'm going to do a QFT example next, it somehow seemed like a lot more mysterious when applied to quantum field, at least for me, seeing it all worked out for just for the harmonic oscillator in like 0+1 dimensional quantum mechanics helped to demystify it. I guess I shouldn't have started erasing. Are there any questions on this before I move on to the QFT example? Okay, cool. Okay. So I'm going to do next a QFT example. Let me say that I'm going to do four examples, and the fourth one is single field slow roll inflation, and this time dependent harmonic oscillator is number one. So here's number two, which is the massless scalar field. On a non-dynamical De Sitter spacetime. And I think I mentioned this definition in a previous lecture that De Sitter spacetime, for purposes of this class, is going to be an FLRW spacetime with constant h. And I suppose I should say curvature equal to zero. Oops. Okay. So this would be a universe with no matter, radiation, or curvature, just a positive cosmological constant. One thing you can show, before I write down the action for this theory, let me just write down a few equations for the spacetime that it's put on. Using proper time as the time coordinate, the metric would be written this way, where the scale factor here is e to the ht. Time goes from minus infinity to infinity. If h is constant, then a prime over a is constant. It's equal to a. And so integrating that equation gives a equals e to the ht. I would actually like to use conformal time for this theory. It turns out to be a little simpler. I just briefly introduced conformal time in the first part of the class. Conformal time is a time coordinate tau. One thing I think I forgot to say before is that Bauman notes use the symbol eta for conformal time, but I like tau a little bit better. It's just an alternate time coordinate where the metric looks like some function of time multiplied by the Minkowski metric.
The two time coordinates are related by d tau equals dt over a. If I integrate this differential equation, I can find tau in terms of t. I'm going to do this quickly because I'd like to know the form of a in conformal time. I'll write this as dt over e to the ht. For the first part is true in general, and the second part is true for de Sitter. Integrating this equation, I'll get t equals tau equals minus 1 over h times e to the minus ht. I'll write that as minus 1 over ah. I'll rearrange that equation to get a equals minus 1 over h tau. Transporting that over here, a of tau is 1. With this choice of integration constant, the conformal time tau runs from minus infinity to 0. In proper time, there's no big bang or big crunch. The total proper time, both in the past and the future, is infinite. In conformal time, there's a finite amount of conformal time at the future, and tau equals 0 corresponds to future infinity. You showed in the tutorial that that happens whenever w is less than minus 1/3, as in the space-time where w is minus 1. And then the action for this theory I'm going to take the usual action for a scalar field minimally coupled to some metric g mu nu, and then specialize it to the de Sitter metric. By the way, one thing that I'm not including here is a mass term, minus 1/2 m squared phi squared. That is the subject of the second problem in homework 2, is to figure out how to generalize to the case of a field with non-zero mass. Specialized to the de Sitter metric, it looks like this. I kind of like writing it this way first. In this line, I've specialized to the case of a general FRW metric with scale factor A of tau, but not all the way to de Sitter. Let me see. This is. What the theory looks like in FLRW. The next line, the square root of minus g, I'm specializing to an FLRW metric in conformal time, where the metric looks like this. The square root of minus g gives 4 powers of a, the g here with two upper indices gives minus 2 powers of a. for an overall A squared. And then all I'm doing is in the second line is specializing to the De Sitter case, where A squared is 1 over H tau squared. But I'll also take the opportunity to go from real space to Fourier space. Minus k squared. I guess I need some stars now. In this form, the theory looks like a bunch of time-dependent harmonic oscillators, one for each k, or more accurately, for each value of k, the real and imaginary parts of phi k behave as independent harmonic oscillators with some time dependence in their action. The only small difference compared to what I did before is that before the time dependence, the p squared term in the action I assumed was time independent, and I put some time dependence in front of the x squared term. And here both the p squared and the x squared terms have some time dependence. Okay, so I'll finish connecting this example with the time dependent harmonic oscillator and solving this theory next time. Before we break for tomorrow, would anyone like to ask a question on any of this content? Okay, cool. In that case, I'll see you tomorrow at 11:30.